As Ireland's former chief rabbi, Ephraim Mervis, heard recently on BBC Radio 4's Thought for the Day.
Good morning. A lonely swan has been in the news this week. It came to Frampton Marsh in Lincolnshire last winter with a large group of other hooper swans. Sadly, a damaged wing prevented it from returning home in the spring, while the others made the long and arduous journey to their breeding grounds in Iceland. Now it is reported that within days, the lonely swan's family and friends will be returning to Frampton Marsh, and a lot of hooping is to be expected when the long-awaited reunion takes place.
John Bradley is manager of the Frampton Marsh Nature Reserve, and he's on the line now. John, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
All good, John. Tell me about Hula the Hooper Swan.
Well, Hula the Hooper, as it's been called. We don't know if it's a male or a female, but what we noticed was last winter, the swan must have had an accident somehow because it sustained some damage to its left wing. And it's not been able to fly very much, so it obviously wasn't able to get back to Iceland with its friends and family, so stayed the summer with us.
When it came first, was it a juvenile or an adult swan?
We only noticed Hula when she had or he had the injury, so we don't know how long the swan's been here, because we have a regular herd of about 60 or so that spend the winter with us and have done for a few years now. So it is possible that Hula's been here and made the migration back and forth to Iceland on a few occasions now, but we only noticed the problem towards the end of the winter, last winter.
So it got damaged actually on the marsh, because obviously it got there with its two wings working, and then while it was there, this accident occurred.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what happened. I mean, power lines, regrettably, are often the main cause of injuries and usually death, unfortunately, to swans. So we're not quite sure, but must have clipped something pretty hard, because obviously they normally molt their feathers, and if there was any small damage, that could have recovered, but I'm suspecting it's something a bit more serious, and the damage is still there, so Hula spent the summer with us.
Well, at least it's got here, at least it's got some education, even if it is a first year and it's learned the way to Britain from Iceland. Normally, of course, it gets another lesson on the way back, which it didn't have if it was a first year swan. Now, you treated this, did you? And that is an interesting thing to be able to do. What was the damage to the wing?
We haven't treated it as such, no. We just managed the habitat here for swans and other wildfowl. So I think Hula's just been quite lucky. Because Hula's on a nature reserve, and obviously it's pretty safe here, generally speaking. So there aren't too many threats from predators or you know, road traffic, or actually we don't have any power lines on the nature reserve, so pretty safe in that respect. So able to find food and be safe, it'll survive the summer.
So what happened then when the family came back, or did they come back?
Yeah, they did. The others have come back in the last few days, actually. So it was fascinating because, yeah, pretty lonely existence through the whole of the summer. And then we had a bit of excitement last weekend when some swans arrived, some other hooper swans arrived on their, about 2,000-mile journey from Iceland. And, yeah, they were all seen associating. It was quite emotional, really.
So this bird has not been able to fly, is that right? So this bird has been sort of stuck in the marshland all summer, so it isn't able to fly, is that right?
It can fly short distances, so, you know, like a few hundred metres, but it doesn't look very comfortable, so it's definitely not up for the 2,000-mile journey up to Iceland.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's not unusual sometimes to have, you know, some of these hooper swans staying. There's one that spent the summer here in Ireland down at Cahor Marsh in County Wexford, and that bird seemed to be well able to fly. It just seemed to live this solitary existence, and, you know, perhaps when the whoopers come back in, it will rejoin them and fly off again next spring. But I just, like, I was curious to know if it really is injured, if it's not been able to fly, or is it just a bird that, you know, perhaps was unwell, you know, in the autumn or the winter that you know, didn't move off last spring then, and, you know, would it have recovered? So it'll be interesting. Have you caught and colour ring this bird, or can you identify this bird from the others that will be there throughout the winter?
Yeah, it's a good point. We haven't had a hooper swan do this before, but we have had Brent geese, and we get, you know, several thousand Brent geese come here in the winter. And, you know, each summer there are two or three that don't make the journey back to Siberia, and they obviously know what they're in for, so they think, no, I'm getting a bit old. I think I'll just hang over here for the rest of the summer. In the case of Hula, it's quite evident there's damage on the left wing, so you can see the primary feathers hanging down.
Okay.
And it's been like that for 6 months or so now, so it does look like it's, you know, a pretty significant injury. And whilst it can fly, as I say, a few hundred metres, the bigger journey is going to be beyond it, unfortunately.
So when the swans come back, they generally come with the new babies from the year in the summertime. So coming back at this time of the year, there'll be new baby swans, like one-year-olds that were born this year coming there. So did Hula get to meet new grandchildren, new nieces and nephews? Because obviously they weren't Hula's swans, but they might have been related to her.
Yeah, what we don't know, of course, is quite who Hula's relatives are when they come back, because we haven't got, you know, neck collars or rings that will tell us if it's brother or sister or mother or father or whatever. But it will be fascinating when the first of the young ones come, and they haven't travelled down yet. It tends to be the adults without young, I think, that make the journey first. But we're likely to see some of the young, and you can tell those because they're grey coloured, and obviously the adults are pure white. So we will be expecting a few of the young swans to come in the next few weeks as well. It'll be fascinating to see the interaction. Hula seemed very happy when there was a couple of adults that joined it, and I've no idea whether they were relatives or just friends, but they did spend some time together. But what tends to happen is that they go and feed on the winter wheat, the local neighbouring farmer's land, and Hula hasn't joined them to do that. So although they've met up, they are going their separate ways during the day. In fact, I'm watching Hula right now. It's having a bit of a lazy day, I have to say. Didn't get up till 10 o'clock and has actually started to go to... it's having a bit of a siesta already. So it's not too tough here, obviously, for Hula in terms of finding food. So it seems reasonably happy.
Often captive swans form liaisons with other species of swan. And I've seen hybrid swans in the wild in Ireland, half hooper, half mute. Is there any tendency in this fellow to conduct such relationships?
We haven't noticed anything like that. There are mute swans here as well. And of course, they do stay the summer. And we do have breeding mute swans on site. But no, I haven't seen any suggestion so far. But maybe if Hula stays... you know, another summer or two, things might get amorous, and we'll have to wait and see on that one.
Okay.
Do the swans hoop? I mean, with singing birds, it's the males that hoop. So in this case of hooper swans, do the males and females both hoop, and do they hoop all the year round? Or when Hula was there all during the summer, was it hooping? Is hooping just a winter behaviour, or does it happen all the year round, and do they all do it?
I think they all do it, and yes, I haven't really heard much from Hooper through the summer, so there hasn't been too much in the way of lonely hooping. I think they, you know, Hula realised that the others had well gone through the summer, and probably realised that, you know, I'm not really supposed to be here, but there's not much I can do about it. Just landed now, actually out of sight. But
how far did
really
she
struggle?
How far did it fly? I'm just curious now.
About 500 metres, I would say. So didn't seem to struggle too much either. I mean, you could see the damage on the left wing, and it, you know, it's obviously significant enough to prevent it from making that big journey. But in terms of local movement, doesn't seem to be too much of a problem, which, if it was, that could be serious. Because, I mean, for example, if Hula was only able to feed, you know, in the grassland areas, then that would be a problem at night, because the predators like foxes might be able to get there to the swans. So all the swans that stay here with us, they roost in the middle of our open water reed bed in the winter. So they are protected by, from predators, which is obviously a very sensible thing to do. So obviously Hula is able to do that. So
I'm protected from you too, I'm thinking, John, because I remember last year myself and Richard were in County Westmeath in a place called Emper. We met Vincent Nally, the farmer, and he had hundreds of hooper swans. And every time we tried to get close to them, off they went.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Hula's actually become a bit tamer, so I know exactly what you mean, because they are quite wary, hooper swans. You know, you're used to getting really close up to mute swans, and in fact, you know, them hissing at you when you get, you know, within a few metres of them. But yeah, hooper swans generally, and the rest of the flock here, they would take off probably at around about 100 metres or so.
Yep.
But Hula, I mean, it came really close to our 360 hide the other day, and I'm talking about 8 metres away, so that is highly unusual. So I suspect that obviously habituation and seeing people around all the time here, because it's quite a busy nature reserve, has given the swan the confidence that actually you know, people aren't quite so bad after all, and I don't really need to worry about it too much.
By the way, just before you go, describe Frampton Marsh. Where exactly are you and what does it look like?
Well, we're on the east coast of England. So if you look at the map, you see there's a big chunk missing between Norfolk and Yorkshire. That's the Wash, and it's one of the largest estuaries in the country and one of the most important in Europe. So we're talking about 450,000 birds come for the winter, and Frampton Marsh is on the edge of that. So it's a piece of wetland habitat, adjacent freshwater wetland habitat, adjacent to the salt marshes and mudflats. So it's got reed beds and big wet grass and habitats, and also freshwater scrapes with pools and islands. So quite a variety of birds in a very small area. So I'm looking at sort of several thousand widgeon right now as I talk to you, and we've got big numbers of wading birds, dunlins and so forth. So it's a really nice nature reserve on the edge of the Wash.
Sounds like the perfect place for a weekend break. You'd love it, Eric, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely.
You'd be right,
yeah,
up your street, a busman's holiday. John, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure, thank you.
Thank you, and do keep us informed. Eric, birds get blown off course. I was going to say all the time, but you used to run the Birds of Ireland News Service.
That's right, yes.
Which would inform twitchers when, yes, rare birds showed up on our shores.
This is the autumn, and as you remember my book, Don't Die in Autumn, this is the key period of birding. And it's the season that really gets me up and running, and it's so exciting. And, you know, we're always watching, you know, we've had Ophelia, and it's very interesting. Ophelia originated off Africa. Most of these, you know, big storms that we get are tail ends of hurricanes. And what happens is that the hurricanes form over the hot waters of Africa and then move across into the Caribbean. We'll often then go up along the east coast of North America and then hit colder water, and almost like a rock, you know, a stone skimming off the water, are sort of sent across the Atlantic back towards Ireland, towards Western Europe. And we get these big storms. But Ophelia was different than that. Ophelia, you know, originated south and moved almost directly north, which was very unusual. But these normal hurricane tracks and these storms pick up migrant birds. And if you can imagine that, we had a big storm at the beginning of October. I was down in Kerry. We went looking for seabirds, and it was like, it must have been storm force 8, and strong westerly winds. It was extraordinary, really, really tough. Nothing like Ophelia, but really, really heavy winds. But that had originated out in the Atlantic, off the east coast of North America. And what happens is, if you can imagine, that birds are migrating off sort of Canada, so southeast Canada, and they will often do a loop over the ocean into the Caribbean and into their wintering grounds in Central America. And then they head off out to sea, you know, probably 100, 200 kilometres off the east coast of the United States. And then they meet this hurricane, which is coming at them, and they can't fly through it, so they fly with it. And if this hurricane, or tail end of a hurricane, which is an Atlantic storm, crosses the Atlantic within a couple of days, it can deliver a cargo of exhausted North American species on the European shores. And that's what happened at the beginning of October. There's a little warbler type bird called a red-eyed vireo. It's a wonderful little bird. And there was at least four or five of those in Ireland during the first week of October. There was a blackbird-like bird called a scarlet tanager, and that was found on Mizzen Head. There was a blackpole warbler, tiny little warbler that you know is a Canadian breeder, and that was on Belmullet. So you can imagine, I saw one of these red-eyed vireos and I photographed one down in County Kerry, and it was in a gully, and it was a windy day and it was a grey day. And you're in the presence of a bird that is no bigger than a robin that has crossed the Atlantic Ocean. And, you know, you can't help but...
Not on a ship.
But they're never going to get back, are they?
No,
that's the question. This is the point.
There's a couple of questions. Before you get on to any question, they're never going to get back. So how did you know what it was?
Well, a friend of mine
Have you seen one of these birds before?
I have. I've seen lots and lots.
Is there any bird in the world...
Oh, there's lots of birds
identified
in the world
already that you could not identify?
Well, I could. Maybe not. There's so many. It's like birds in South America, for example, ant birds and all of these, which they all look very, very similar. But if I saw one, I would know that it's an ant bird species. Let's put it that way. I mean, I've been very lucky in that I've travelled, you know, in South and Central America and Asia and, you know, Africa.
Yeah, but you can't see everything, Eric.
No. I've only seen about... I've seen about 3,000 species of the 10,000. So there's still another 7,000 to go. And I'll never get to see them all. Nobody does. But, you know, you come across something.
You go on Mastermind, yeah. Specialist subject.
But you come across like a
but you
word.
Know which group.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I've seen several red-eye vireos before in Ireland, and I've seen hundreds of them on their wintering grounds. I've seen them in their breeding grounds in North America. I've seen them in their wintering grounds in Central and South America. So, you know all of these warblers. But it's the concept that this bird can get blown across the Atlantic and can...
How long would it take?
...survive. Well, this is the point. A lot of these birds can only have enough fat reserve to get them for maybe 3 or 4 days. It's a bit like an aeroplane. You know, if you're going to fly the Atlantic...
You need enough fuel.
And many of these birds only can store enough fat reserves to get them across the Atlantic in 3 or 4 days. If that wind or if that storm weakens and it takes 5 or 6 days, all of those birds are gone. Now, for the small group of birds that were found, maybe 4 or 5 red-eyed vireos, a black pole warbler, scarlet tanager, it's what, seven or eight species, 7 or 8 individuals. How many other birds were blown in that storm?
And didn't make it. Yeah, remember, they weren't planning coming here in the first place. So they weren't building up any reserves.
Yeah, that's the point. How many birds actually did make it but were never seen? I mean, like, it's very possible that somebody was going, oh, that's a very unusual bird on the feeder and it's like a first record for Europe. You know, it's only the birders that are out there that are finding these things.
Only fellas like you that know
that are identifying them.
So, Aina's question.
First of all, did that come up with Ophelia from Africa?
Well, no, this is the interesting one. Ophelia hasn't produced anything major. Now, having said that, there was a little thrush found on Cape Clear, or not in Cape Clear, on Galley Head yesterday, and it was still present there this morning, a little bird called a great-cheeked thrush. Now, that great-cheeked thrush is a North American thrush, and that was found yesterday. Now, is that as a result of Ophelia? It is very, very possible. But again, for a great-cheeked thrush to be off the Azores is rare enough. So is this a bird that got blown across in an earlier storm that was trying to reorientate itself by going south? We don't know.
The poor creature, then it gets hauled up again by Ophelia.
But then, sorry, just to even extend it, sorry, I don't mean to hog this because it's my... I could talk...
Hog away, but before you hog too much, is it going back? Aina's question, before we forget, will they ever get back?
No, these birds are, if they reorientate themselves, they'll be going north-south on the wrong side of the world for the rest of their lives. And, you know, that sounds quite tragic, but in many ways, it's nature's way of
Now, hang on a second, Eric. I remember 1992 when that Kemp's Ridley turtle was washed up on Bannerstrand in County Kerry, and the big effort that was made to get it back to the Gulf of Mexico because they only breed on this one stretch of beach, Rancho Nuevo, in the Gulf of Mexico, and nowhere else. So why isn't the same effort made for birds to get them back?
But many of the birds that will turn up are birds that are a bit like chiffchaffs and willow warblers. You know, they're not... These individuals are part of quite a large population. And look, I hear what you're saying, and I sort of agree with you on an emotional point of view on that. If we're going to go to that expense to try and bring an individual back, we should be maybe putting the money into conserving the habitat where these species nest, because a lot of these birds are under pressure.
Yeah, well, that had nothing to do with the reason it ended up here, let's be honest. Anyway, so go on. So it's never going to make it back, is what you're saying.
That was the answer to Aina's question. But then you have... A totally different sort of situation in that on Cape Clear Island, at the beginning of this week just gone, there was another American thrush called a Swainson's thrush. Now, again, the weather wasn't correct for this bird to be blown across. It probably got blown across earlier in the week and is just reorientating itself, heading south on the wrong side. But the following day, in the exact same place, was a bird called a rustic bunting. Now, a rustic bunting, we have reed buntings, they're like yellowhammers. They're members of the bunting family. But rustic buntings are Siberian species. I was in Japan over Christmas, and that's where rustic buntings are all wintering. So in one garden on, say, you know, Sunday, you have an American thrush, and the following day, you have a bird that should be spending the winter in Japan. And what's going on there? And the rustic bunting is a classic example. There's lots of other birds that from Siberia that turn up on a regular basis in Western Europe. And it's not wind that gets them blown off course. It's a theory called reverse migration. And it sounds very complicated, but it's very simple. That there's a set number of birds that are born with a compass in their brain. And most birds from Siberia will head from the northwest to the southeast. So they might be born in Siberia and head to India or head to Japan. So the migration is northwest, southeast. But the theory is that there's a small proportion of these birds born with an anomaly in their brain that heads northwest instead. So instead of heading southeast, they go in the opposite direction. They reverse migrate. And of course, the world being a globe, if you put that, you know, track directly from the Siberia and head it northwest, it goes over the Ural Mountains, over Scandinavia and hits Western Europe. So these birds are actually travelling in the wrong direction. They're not blown off course by weather. They're actually going in the wrong direction in the first place. And what's that about? The theory is that these are explorers for the species, possibly eking out new wintering grounds for the species. Because if you can imagine you put all your eggs in one basket, like you put the entire population in one place for the winter, and some natural disaster occurs in that area, well, your species is gone. But if you've got two separate wintering grounds, well, then if anything happens on either, at least the species survives. And that's the theory. And I buy into that.
Do you? So they should be called Columbus birds.
They are. You're actually...
They're called Columbus birds?
Yeah.
Are they? They're not.
No,
come on.
They're not.
But they should be.
But I feel I am in the presence of great explorers.
Well, you're in the presence of greatness, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, but like, you know, these birds are extraordinary. They're pushing out the boundaries for their species. And it's working. There's a little bird called a Siberian chiffchaff. And... that's, you know, hasn't really occurred in Ireland that often in winter. And about 10 years ago, they started turning up.
Mm.
Now there are wintering Siberian chiffchaffs in Ireland every year. When you think about migration, and we're talking about the swans, this drive to migrate, it's something that is really difficult to explain. You know, birds like cuckoos, they've never even met their parents. They've never flown with other cuckoos. They don't even know they're cuckoos until they reach Africa, because they don't meet other cuckoos until they reach Africa. They're raised by meadowpipits.
Yeah, the hardwiring, we're looking often at the scars of evolution. The bird that comes to mind is a thing called the demoiselle crane, a beautiful bird you will see in India. Now, it breeds up in the steppes of Central Asia, Mongolia, up around that area. And at the end of the winter, it migrates down to India to breed. And now, what's in the way? The Himalayas, 8,000 metres high, 1,400 kilometres across. And yet, it heads right up over this. And lots of them die. They get exhausted. They get beaten back by the weather. They can't eat up there. There's a dreadful attrition rate. Now, they do this. But yet, there is a pass they could use through the Khyber Pass area. There is a little route, a valley, that takes you through the Himalayas. If you move slightly to the west and went down this passage, you'd end up in India without having... We only fly up 1,000 metres or something like that, you'd get into India fine. Yet these dimwit birds haven't copped on to this. Despite all that time, they're still hooked on the old scars of evolution that they invented years and years ago. They still do the stupid thing and they can't make up their minds to do anything different. Isn't that a warning?
Yeah, absolutely. And
maybe they don't know it's there.
But exactly. But if that was a crow,
yeah, that's the
crow
point.
Would be through it. He wouldn't even go over the Himalayas woods because he's a bright boy.
But there's interesting,
he's able to do that.
There's a lot of interesting stuff going on with geolocators on birds now, and you have radio tracking on birds, and they've radio tracked cuckoos, as we know. It's a study that's going on in England. And the idea was that we sort of knew where cuckoos went, and we knew what direction they went. They went straight over the Sahara Desert, and they put radio tags on four different cuckoos, and two went straight over the desert, but two, like what you said, didn't risk going over the desert. They skirted around the outside of Africa, on the west of Africa, and spent the winter in the Congo. So you had two birds that were hardwired to go over the desert, but two who sort of said, well,
presumably that was inbred into them genetically, but from their parents who had come that way.
Yeah, but this is the point. So in other words, you know, it's perhaps proof that birds can adapt to a changing environment and introduce new migration routes into the species.
The animal that comes to mind is the hedgehog. He's a medievalist. He goes into sieges, puts out the thorns, and this has worked for countless millennia. And when a car bears down on him with the bright lights, he does the same. Mm. And you see what happens. Surely some old hedgehog somewhere says, let's have a think about this. Perhaps I'll go to the side of the road before I curl up. But they don't seem to be able to do it.
No one comes back to tell them, you see.
But it's like the young turtles that are drawn, you know, to the lights along the beaches of these resorts. You know, you have this hardwired thing that you follow something that's in inbred in you. And it's a very hard thing to describe. I mean, you look at monarch butterflies. I mean, I had the pleasure of being in Mexico about a year and a half ago. And we were down there in winter. There's a place called El Rosario. It's in the mountains. Wonderful place. Great for birds. But it's the sort of wintering quarters of monarch butterflies. Now, these are butterflies. You know, they don't have like a brain as we know it. There's something like 40, 50 million butterflies in the trees. And it's a beautiful place. It's you know, you go up and you think these trees are all bedecked by autumn leaves, but they're these beautiful orange butterflies. And when you think what these butterflies are going to do, they'll start moving north and they reach a certain point. They lay eggs. The adults die. Caterpillars emerge. They produce, you know,
more
butterflies. They move north, and then they and this goes on for at least three or four generations. So by the time you're up in Canada, the butterflies that are flying around Canada are fourth generation butterflies that left Mexico, right? And then in the autumn, all of these butterflies migrate back to the exact mountain. They've never been there.
And they do it all in one fell swoop.
Yeah, they do it all in one fell swoop, but they've never been there. Like, how can a butterfly, fourth generation, have such a genetic preposition to not just go back to Central, but back to the same mountain?
People won't be able to sleep tonight pondering that, Eric.
This is what gets me out of bed.
It does. Well, it's going to keep people in bed pondering. Anyway, Eric Dempsey, thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Aileen Nilana, to Richard Collins, our researchers this week, John Riley and Elaine Carraher. Our broadcast coordinator is Sinead Renshaw. Our producer is Anna Leddy. And on sound, we had Sheila Neve-Weil. Until next time, goodbye.